You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We are joined today by Ken Vogel, who's a chief investigative reporter for Politico. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. Before joining Politico prior to its 2007 launch, Ken reported for the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington, the Times Leader in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., and the Journal Inquirer in Manchester, Connecticut. He spent most of 2006 learning about the U.S. Congress from the inside, through an American Political Science Association fellowship that let him work on the staffs of two House committees. He's won awards from the Association of Capitol Reporters and Editors, the Society of Professional Journalists and Investigative Reporters and Editors. He's analyzed politics on CBS, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, National Public Radio, and radio and television stations around the country. He's also the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics, which came out in June of 2014, and it chronicles the characters and motivations behind the explosion of unlimited money in politics after the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. Now, I'm a bit of a political junkie, which is hard not to be when living here in Washington, and so I've read several of Ken's articles, but an article he wrote in mid-November really caught my eye and prompted me to invite him here. It was an article about the Koch brothers, who are some of, if not the, most divisive people in American politics. To the American right, billionaires Charles and David Koch are champions of conservative principles, fighting for government deregulation and free enterprise. To the left, they are the ultimate political villain, especially after they pledged to spend a little less than $900 million in a 2016 election to defeat Democrats and liberal causes. There is, of course, nuance, as there always is. The Kochs have given hundreds of millions of dollars to charitable causes, ranging from museums to the arts to universities and educational programs around the country. They are also pro-choice, pro-gay rights, pro-stem cell research, and have worked with the Obama administration and the ACLU on prison and criminal justice reform. But nuance doesn't always carry the day in the world of politics, and so the Koch brothers will continue to be a divisive symbol of modern American politics. Perhaps nothing encapsulates this like Ken Vogel's November article, entitled, and here's where the listeners will finally understand why I'm talking about all of this, the Koch Intelligence Agency. So thank you, Ken, for joining us here at the International Spy Museum.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Vince.
So looking at your past articles, you're a bit of a Koch brothers expert, as much as anybody can be, which makes sense since you track the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. Can you talk a little bit about your background and the background that got you into looking at these very enigmatic brothers?
Yeah, so I've long covered politics at different levels, as you alluded to in the introduction there, covering cops in courts outside of Hartford, Connecticut, and working my way up to covering state legislatures in Pennsylvania, in Washington State, in Wisconsin, before moving to D.C. to cover national politics. And each of those steps, I kind of focused on money in politics, the influence of money in politics, the way money floods into the political system in elections, but also in governing and lobbying, as sort of a sideline. And I always thought that it undergirded every story, but that thinking, I think, became a little more widespread, a lot more widespread after the Citizens United decision in 2010 that you alluded to, where unlimited money just sort of started flooding into the process and really changing the way that we do politics. Well, again, as you alluded to, the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch, have really become personifications of the new sort of big money politics, and they've almost become the operation that they've built. It's not just their own money. Let me also make that clear. Their power comes from their own wealth, which is estimated at $40 billion, billion with a B, each, but also their ability to convene this large group of other like-minded conservative donors, you know, Republicans, but even more sort of libertarians who want to change politics. And they have become almost a party, a political party unto themselves, a privatized political party with many of the capabilities and the outreach techniques and the access to politicians that rival those of the official Republican Party. Now, they also, because they are not bound by some of the same types of regulations, disclosure requirements, and limits on the amount of money that they can accept into this network of groups that they have and spend through this network of groups that they have, they are able to be a bit more aggressive even than the party. Well, this intelligence agency that you allude to is sort of a perfect case in point of that.
Yeah, and for the listeners out there that are thinking, I brought in a liberal firebrand to rip on the Republicans, your book, which has such an amazing title, was reviewed favorably in the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, the Financial Times, not exactly liberal bastions of analysis. And so I think that Politico especially, it doesn't necessarily have, it's not Fox News, it's not MSNBC with a direct, you know, lean, let's call it, to one direction or the other. But Politico tends to be center-right in its overall performance. And kind of bringing that out so that people out there in the world won't think that I'm bringing in a pet project here to talk about the Kochs.
I mean, I would quibble. Certainly there are people who perceive Politico to be center-right or center-left. I would quibble with that and say that, like, our goal is to be as right down the middle as possible, traditional journalism sort of manifest in the digital age in ways that, you know, I think a more fair criticism could be, are sometimes sensationalistic or treat politics more as sport. But in my journalism in particular, I try to take a really hard look at some of the phenomena that are affecting politics and sort of to your deeper point as it pertains to this particular subject, money in politics. I've taken a very hard look at liberal donors and the coalitions that they have tried to build to respond to this new era of big money politics after the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. And in fact, the liberal donors are also acutely attuned to the activities of the Kochs, and the liberal groups are to the point where they sometimes seem to be obsessing or fixating on the Kochs and trying to respond to the Kochs. Now, this is interesting because if you go back sort of through say, the last decade when money has really started to flow into the process in different ways, there has been a tendency by both sides to think the other side is doing something right. That we need to play catch-up. They have a piece on the chessboard that we don't have, and we need to have that piece. The Kochs believe that, in fact, the left has done things. The left's big money donors, outside groups, labor unions that have tended to be sympathetic of the left, some aspects of academia and the media that they believe to be, you know, in the pocket of the left, to put right. it more of a point on it. And so, frankly, this effort that I wrote about, this intelligence agency, stems from their concern that somehow they are behind, and right. that in order to be effective in this new type of big money politics, what they need to do is match the left, and to match the left, they need to figure out precisely what the left is doing in real time. And they didn't think, after the 2012 election, when they really burst onto the scene, both as big money spenders and as liberal bogeymen for liberals as the personification right. of the corrupting influence of money in politics, they spent $400 million during that election cycle and lost badly. President Barack Obama won re-election. Democrats retained control of the Senate. And they, one of the conclusions that they reached in a forensic analysis that they did after the election of their spending and that of all big money spenders and interest groups, was that they had sort of been outmaneuvered by the left. And this intelligence effort was an attempt to make sure that even if they were getting outmaneuvered in real time, they could respond and they right. would not be caught unawares of what the other side was doing.
Yeah, about a year ago, we had Chuck Todd on Spycast, and we talked about how intelligence tradecraft has trickled down to political campaigns, things like tracking and opposition research. This seems like that on steroids. I mean, I think in the article itself, you have someone quoted saying this is 10 times the level of any modern political campaign, the amount of resources and time that's being put into this. Is this scale something we've ever seen before in politics?
I don't think so. And I think actually I tend to agree with what Chuck said and what you just articulated there, that increasingly we see sort of tradecraft working its way into campaigns, and we see it manifest itself in sort of what we call OPPO, opposition mm-hmm. research. There is an element of that in this intelligence effort that I wrote about on the Kochs. But where I really think the influence comes from is from the corporate side. And the Kochs have been very open about infusing their political efforts and their efforts to influence public policy with some of the management techniques, some of the resources, tools, even the talent from their multinational industrial conglomerate, Koch Industries, mm-hmm. which is the second biggest private company in the United States behind only Caterpillar. And this, I think, is one of those ways where right. this bears a lot of the hallmarks of sort of corporate intelligence, right. corporate espionage,
well, as
more
you say, they
than
call
political.
It, they call it competitive intelligence.
Right, exactly. And the competitive gets to this point that you were talking about that I mentioned earlier, that they don't – that it's the competition. It's the left. They want to see what the left right. is doing. And to date, I have not really seen any evidence that they have used this – the fruits of this effort to plant a hit job on a liberal rival right. or a conservative rival, which is really the purpose of opposition right. research in the traditional sense. Instead, it's trying to figure out, hey, if the left is going into this big race in Virginia, maybe it's not a big race. Maybe it's a House race that was not on the radar of many sort of odds makers, political prognosticators. And they detect through this intelligence effort, which includes like geodata tracking.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that because it looks like it's straight out of what the agencies are doing with open source research, is using social media and geotagging on pictures to be able to find out the location. Yeah. Of opposition operatives.
And the way that this could bear itself out in a way that could be useful, that gets to what I was talking about responding to the left's efforts, is this is the example that was cited to me by the source who flagged that thing about the geodata tracking, is that it's not enough to sort of look at like the public what's available publicly, and I say publicly in sort of the sense that what the left or what their rival groups are actually willingly putting out there for public consumption, or even for consumption within the sort of left, the closed circuits of the left.
Right.
This is stuff where they would want to see, oh, I see that this union organizer tweeted a photo of himself and a group of his union buddies at Chick-fil-A, and it doesn't say where the Chick-fil-A is, but when we look at the geodata on the photo, it shows that the Chick-fil-A is in this particular congressional district in Virginia where they would not otherwise be, because they're based in Washington, D.C.,
right.
Say southwestern Virginia, and there happens to be a congressional race that we are paying attention to, but we haven't devoted any resources to in that particular area of southwest Virginia. Well, we should be tracking these folks to see if any other
right.
indication emerges that they are there in southwestern Virginia for any period of time. That would suggest that union is perhaps, or that liberal group is perhaps, investing in that race in a way that we might need to match if we want to be able to win that race.
Right. Well, what I also found interesting inside your article is this idea with intelligence of compartmentalization of information, or the need to know. You talk about the fact that a lot of people, even within the Koch network, don't know that this agency, let's call it that, exists, this intelligence framework.
Yeah, and they would get emails. Some of my sources would get emails from this weird address that was at amersg.org, and they were like, who are these people? And so they called them ASG, and we couldn't figure out what that stood for until we went through the tax filings of one of the umbrella groups in the Koch network, a group that's called Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce. And when we did that, we found that this group referred to American Strategies Group, LLC, which is actually a for-profit entity that's owned by this nonprofit group that is the umbrella group in the Koch network, and it houses this competitive intelligence group. It was originally located off-site in one of the sort of clusters of buildings around the Courthouse Metro Station in Northern Virginia, where the Kochs have a lot of their political efforts headquartered. Now it is sort of more a part of this Freedom Partners, but people would get summoned to this office and they wouldn't be able to find it. People
right.
within the Koch network for briefings or to exchange information. And one source of mine said he was summoned out there, couldn't find it. They finally directed him to it, and he explained, yeah, I just couldn't find it. They said, that's the way we like it.
Well, I mean, just reading it, you have the staff that includes a former CIA analyst. They put out regular intelligence briefings. I mean, if this wasn't about a campaign, this would be exactly what a foreign intelligence agency or a domestic intelligence agency was doing.
Yeah, and I think that they relish that idea a little bit, the comparison, and they didn't do much boasting about it, frankly. I had to drag a lot of this information out of them and to use the tax filings and use sources, and some of a source actually provided me one of the intelligence briefings. It was pretty impressive. I see a lot of these intelligence briefings that probably this is also probably a good comparison with government intelligence. You know, you see some of these things. Oh, I could have put that together. That's just a Google search. But this had some like very granular information about particular races and investments by particular unions and environmental groups that I thought, maybe if I really put my mind to it, I could have like found some of that stuff. But it struck me as benefiting from on-the-ground resources
right.
in some of these places.
Well, you also write that you discovered some of the interest in intelligence about the inner workings of the left wing revealed by secret audio recordings from a June 2014 panel discussion at a closed-door donor gathering.
Right, it cuts both ways, obviously. And that's one of the things that they are concerned about, is that they feel like they are getting penetrated by this type of thing, that the left is doing this to them, and
right.
so they have to respond. And of course, the audio recordings in particular have become such a trove. I mean, there was an audio recording of Mitt Romney at a closed-door fundraiser,
right? Yeah.
That really shaped the race. I mean, arguably was a turning point in that race, leading to Mitt Romney's loss, certainly his inability to appeal to some of these swing demographics that were so key, that he just lost what they called the empathy
right.
Battle right there, the cares about me. And so that's another aspect of this intelligence agency, this American Strategies Group. They are looking for moles within the Koch network. They spend a lot of time assessing social media posts of people within the network, of contractors. I have a story in here about how someone was posting anonymously on Reddit from within the Koch network, casting aspersions on the Kochs and the network and some of their policy objectives. And this group, this ASG group, was sicked on this to find sleuth out who this person was who was posting anonymously. They were able to triangulate using some of the technical side with also their knowledge of who was working for the network and their previous social media monitoring, and they located this person in less than 48 hours, and this person was gone.
Right. Well, one thing you talked about the secret audio recordings, and what was revealed in those secret audio recordings is that the Kochs somehow had gotten their hands on internal secret documents from a group called Democracy Alliance. And so it was spying on a group to discover that that group had been spying on the left back and forth. I mean, it just never ends. It's wonderful. But
it sounds like a plot, just watch the now by the time this airs, the season finale of Homeland will have aired. But it definitely struck me that way. And, in that audio recording, I mentioned previously that the left and some of these liberal donors and liberal groups are obsessed with the Kochs. I think it becomes clear that this high-ranking lawyer within Koch Industries, who also is active in the Koch political network, who is presenting to the donors in this audio recording these documents, that he is quite obsessed with what the left is doing as well.
So we kind of alluded to counterintelligence, for lack of a better word, the idea that the Koch brother network is focusing on an insider threats on people giving information out from within. They're also tracking, according to your article, people deemed suspicious outside of the offices. You have, so there is a physical security element to this where they're worried that there's spies outside. You've already talked about the idea that the offices themselves are very difficult to find. Can you talk a little bit about this, what I would call a counterintelligence role of this Koch Brothers intelligence network?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they are right to assume that people, me in the media, people, liberals, are fascinated with what they're doing. And so it would make sense for someone to try to plant a mole. In fact, there was a story that came out a few weeks after my story suggesting that a liberal group, in fact, had planted a mole inside the Koch network. And so they are very, very anxious about that possibility, about emails leaking.
Right.
I've been told after I've written certain stories that there were comprehensive searches on their servers to see, like, if the language I used in the stories to refer to some phenomenon tracked with any of the language that had been sent in email, so they could determine who the source was. There also have been instances of them tracking reporters. In fact, the suspicious vehicle in the title of my book refers to a run-in that I had at the April 2013 Koch donor seminar out in the desert in California, in Indian Wells, California, where I snuck into one of their meetings and was eventually found out by security and escorted off the premises. And when they escorted me out to my car, they ended up calling and reporting my vehicle as suspicious to the Riverside County Sheriff, who then followed me around. And so there are other instances, for instance, of Jane Mayer is a reporter for The New Yorker. She's written extensively about the Koch network and actually has a book coming out in January about them. And she has alleged that they tried to plan a story about her plagiarizing other stories about the Kochs and ran all of her work through like this sophisticated plagiarism software. There's definitely, I think there's paranoia among the folks who interface with the Kochs to some extent, and maybe some paranoia within the Koch network as well.
Well, one thing I think is interesting, and I'm not going to ask you to reveal sources. Even if I did, I know you're going to laugh in my face because you're a very good journalist. But getting this information, I imagine, wouldn't have been as easy as a phone call or an email address, because their paranoia with potential moles means, I assume, that they're not leaving digital footprints behind communicating with you and other reporters. I mean, in the Hill piece, which you referred to, they actually talk about the idea that old-fashioned, let's call it human intelligence, was the key behind their article, because the Kochs have intense internal surveillance of electronic things like emails and phone calls.
Yeah, that's right. And I talk to a lot of folks who are sources who are either within that network or outside, their former consultants or employees that dealt with the network. And almost to a person, they do not want to exchange emails with me. They do not want me to exchange texts. They'll suggest that I text them with some kind of euphemistic message, and that then we'll talk on the phone. You know, I don't know. Apparently, no one is concerned that the phone calls are being tracked, because that would be the next level, I assume.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things I see is that when asked whether it was from you talking to the people, your sources, or the Hill article, you almost get the Glomar response from the people within these networks, like neither confirming nor denying that these programs exist. I mean, there's the spokesperson for American Bridge, which is the nonprofit arm of the counter Coke operation. Basically, that was the response. Yeah, well, we can neither confirm nor deny that this is actually taking place. I mean, on the record, are you getting those kind of responses? Like, you can only kind of talk off the record.
Yeah, and I think that extends, throughout politics in particular, where people are, especially savvy to how some of this could be perceived. And certainly my story, though, I think it's nuanced and sort of explains the justifications for why they might want to do this, was glommed onto by the left as proving that the Kochs were engaged in some kind of unsavory activity. And so they don't want to have their finger, even if they're acknowledging it, even if they're talking off the record, they don't want to have their finger. They don't want to be seen as like bragging about something like this. Now, it's a fine line, because a lot of these political efforts are in fact funded by donors, or in some cases where they are for-profit entities, investors who are basically donors, politically interested investors. And those folks do want to see some results of their donations or their investment. And so if you are claiming to be, this American Bridge Group, which is run by David Brock, who is the former Clinton self-described right-wing hitman turned Clinton enforcer, then you need to be able to show, if you're running a group that says it's going after the Kochs, you need to be able to prove to these donors, hey, this is what we produced. And whether it's having the results of this alleged mole who is inside the Koch network and being able to show the donors, hey, we got this great piece of intel, in which case that creates a wider network for me as a journalist to potentially penetrate and find a donor who's willing to talk about what the group and David Brock were able to get from inside. And then additionally, they might want to show, in fact, they usually do want to show some tangible results in the form of, look, here's, we got this information and here's what we did with it. Here's how it was helpful, to our side, to what you're funding. Either it allowed us to, as I put it before, put a piece on the chessboard where the other side had a piece and we didn't, or it allowed us to plant a story. David Brock's group famously took credit for digging up some of David Koch's writings or some of his work when he was active in the Libertarian Party back in the late 70s. He was actually the Libertarian Party's vice presidential nominee in 1980. And the New York Times did a front page story about sort of the genesis of David Koch's political philosophy that used a lot of archival material that David Brock's American Bridge Group had dug up. And they actually, this is sort of a rare thing, you seldom see the fingerprints on a story like that in the actual story, but they actually, the Times credited American Bridge with digging up this trove of information. And so, you ask yourself, why would they do that? If they wanted to be a more effective, powerful story, they would just leave themselves out of it and not create the possibility for the Kochs to come back and say, oh, that's just a politically motivated story. But I think it's a donor play. They got to be able to show the donors, here's how your money funding our efforts can actually affect the debate.
Well, and in both your article and the article in The Hill, actually, plus others out there, you see elements of things like, for lack of a better word, talking about disguise, where people are dressing up like middle-aged businessmen to sneak into, you know, conservative donor parties, and vice versa when it comes to what was the now turned out to be somewhat fraudulent, but the guy getting all the video.
The acorn pimp.
Yeah, the acorn right. pimp guy, right? So you see elements of disguise to infiltrate these organizations.
Yeah, we. I mean, I would never misidentify myself as a reporter. You know, I'm bound by journalistic right. ethics that I take seriously. But it is, in fact, true that what you know that meeting that I went to where I got kicked out of and they reported my car as suspicious. I thought to myself in advance, like, let's see, how could I best blend in at this meeting without calling attention to myself? And having been around and actually crashed prior Coke donor seminars, I thought, well, I'm not going to come across as like a major donor. I don't think that there's many major donors who are my age. I'm 40. You know, they tend to be older folks and, you know, very sort of conservatively dressed. And so I thought, well, you know, like it's the operatives, the folks who were either, you know, implementing the plans or begging for the money from the donors where I could conceivably look like someone who might be in that demographic, and they wear pressed khakis and tucked in polo shirts, which is not my normal style. Like to think I'm a little hipper than that, but that's what I wore. Blue blazer, you know, pressed khakis, brown loafers, because I thought that would be the way to draw the least amount of attention to myself. And so you extrapolate outward, and people who are less concerned about misrepresenting themselves might take further steps to blend in. And at these Coke donor seminars, there have also been these recordings that you mentioned where, despite all these efforts to determine that everyone who's there belongs and a very tight security, people have recorded these things, naturally drawing attention to some of the wait staff or servers. And so at these, since then, they have become very diligent about making everyone, including the wait staff and the bartenders and the valets, but even the attendees, the donors themselves, put their phones or any kind of electronics in a bin outside of these strategy sessions where they go into to sort of talk about some of the sensitive stuff because they are that concerned about recordings.
There's a guy who got the 47% recording. Wasn't he part of the
– Yeah, he was a bartender. And even in some of these recordings that I relied on, which, you know, we did not obtain. They were obtained by a liberal blogger who Lauren Windsor, who posted them on her blog, which is Lady Libertine, and then also on some liberal websites. She did stories based on it. She would not reveal her source. And, in fact, there were what appeared to be strategic breaks in the audio that you know, you could imagine would be an effort by her, understandably, to weed out any kind of audio that would allow a listener to determine, oh, that is, you know, a conversation between a waiter and this donor or this donor and that donor or whomever.
Right, someone asking for a drink from this, obviously, directly into the microphone. This is not something new. I mean, opposition research and tracking and using some of these techniques and intelligence techniques in politics have been around for a little while. It seems in this case the Koch brothers are really codifying this as an institution. Do you see, as money continues to grow and grow and grow, you know, the last election was a multi-billion-dollar election. It looks like the 2016 election, whether it's Trump or someone else, will be a multi-billion-dollar election. Until someone does something with Citizens United, do you see more things like this in the future? Is there going to be a George Soros intelligence agency coming up, or a Hollywood-based left media? I'm trying to think of all the boogeymen for the right wing intelligence agency popping up in the future. Do you see this as precedent?
Short answer: yes. Slightly longer answer. In fact, Soros is a donor to this American Bridge group that David Brock runs that is spying on the Kochs, or at least some of the David Brock groups Soros has been a donor to. And then even longer answer, yes, you know, there are already groups on the left and the right who specialize in opposition research. A very prominent one that I should mention on the right is this America Rising. It's both a nonprofit group, a super PAC, and an LLC, a for-profit company, and it does business with campaigns and political party committees that want to essentially outsource this work of tracking candidates, of digging through archival material. And while they are much more discreet, I think, certainly than American Bridge bragging about their mole inside the Koch network, their fingerprints are the fingerprints of sort of similarly situated Republican opposition researchers have been detected in the 2014 race, for instance, on a number of very key stories, including one that forced the resignation or forced the senator from Montana, Walsh, to withdraw from his reelection campaign because his thesis was found to be plagiarized. And, you know, that's the type of thing that no reporter really has the time to go to whatever, you know, college this thesis was at in Montana and dig through the archives to compare it. But there is an interest, you know, by the Republican Party and its candidates and its party committees and its allies to do this type of thing, and the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And so the combination of sort of outsourcing this to a given group that has an economy of scale that can sort of do this type of stuff and by virtue of, like, specialized, develop expertise in it that allows them to do it better, and Citizens United and some of these comparable decisions that have really opened the floodgates to allow groups like this to accept unlimited funding, the confluence of those two things, and the third thing then being, of course, that everyone is doing it. So if you're not doing it, you're putting yourself at a huge disadvantage. You take those three things and put them together. And, yes, I think we're really just seeing the dawn of this big money opposition research political intelligence era.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Cold War historian, and this really brings back the idea of, like, the bomber gap or the missile gap, where we can't allow the other side to get an advantage in a strategic, you know, weapon system. In this case, intelligence becomes a strategic weapon, and you have this back and forth, they're ahead, we're ahead thing. I wonder, I mean, this is a question.
And some of that is for effect. Some of it is, like, to scare your side's big donors to be like, hey, if we don't match what they're doing, we're going to be screwed. But then it does take on sort of a race for the purpose of itself to some extent, like you see or like I see in depictions of intelligence, where, like, you're spending all this time and effort just to penetrate the other side's intelligence, and they're doing the same to you, and who really has the upper hand, it's impossible to know.
So I want to take this conversation, which has been fantastic, a bit toward the absurd. And one last final point to have a conversation about is the story is now peaking out, and this is going to become very dated in a couple months, but the stories that have been popping out from, like, the Bush campaign and others, that Donald Trump is a left-wing plant in the Republican primary. It's ridiculous, but it's a lot of fun to kind of think about this idea that the Clinton campaign, with this mysterious phone call from Bill Clinton right before Trump announced he was running as a Republican, and his over-the-top campaigning have made it someone from within one of the campaigns said, if he was trying to help Hillary Clinton win, he'd be doing exactly the same things that he's doing now. I know this is kind of out there, but you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, I'll say, regardless of this particular story, Donald Trump has been a godsend for us in the political media. I mean, he may be bad for democracy, you know, he may be bad for racial and religious tolerance, but just as a pure news story, he cannot be beat. You know, second of all, I would say whether or not he's a plant, I mean, I find that sort of far-fetched, but the effect is kind of the same thing, you know, whether he's a plant or not. It's like the comment that you referenced by a rival campaign sort of speaks to this idea that, like, he is having a deleterious effect on Republicans' chances of retaking the White House. So whether that's because Bill Clinton put him up to it, or he just, you know, had a bee in his bonnet and decided this was something that he wanted to do, it almost doesn't matter.
Well, Ken Vogel is a chief investigative reporter for Politico. He's the author of a wonderfully titled book, Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. Thank you, Ken, for taking the time to talk to us here today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. And we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.